are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Wake up, KBOO listeners. It's time to support local community-based media this fall by donating and becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give. When you contribute now until September 21st, your donations will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $11,000, thanks to listeners like you. Double the impact and double the fun.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO hosts will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair.
Welcome to Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. This week, we'll continue our examination of the grim dystopia promised by a Project 2025 on immigration, especially in light of the racist Republican rumors against Haitian people in Springfield, Ohio, and we'll explore what a progressive vision of immigration could look like. My guest will be Ivan Espinosa Madrigal of Lawyers for Civil Rights, Boston. Then we'll do the same for economic justice issues. Natalia Renta, Senior Policy Counsel for Corporate Governance and Power at Americans for Financial Reform, will expose Project 2025's plan to decimate government regulatory agencies and federal employee unions, and we'll examine how to build a vision for economic justice and workers' rights as part of our Progress 2025 vision. Finally, we'll pivot to the Trump plan to steal the 2024 election with Arne Pearson of the Center for Media and Democracy. He'll tell us about the fake electors for Trump who have taken over election boards in several counties in 8 swing states. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Republican vice presidential running mate J.D. Vance admitted on national television that he spread false rumors about Haitian migrants consuming people's pets in Springfield, Ohio. In an interview on NBC, he said, quote, "If I have to create stories so that the American media actually pays attention to the suffering of the American people, then that's what I'm going to do," end of quote. Donald Trump at last week's debate with Kamala Harris repeated the rumors, and the Republican presidential ticket has doubled down on them, spurring bomb threats in Springfield and upending the small town that had been experiencing an economic revival, thanks in part to Haitian migrants. The extremist right-wing Heritage Foundation has made immigration its number one issue. Its Project 2025 mandate for a new Republican president targets both undocumented immigrants and legal methods of immigration. The broad vision of Project 2025 is that immigrants don't belong in the United States, and therefore the next administration would have a mandate to dramatically increase the budget of Customs and Border Patrol, completely seal the border with Mexico, eliminate several categories of visas and legal statuses, and federally divest from so-called sanctuary cities. Well, what would a progressive vision of immigration look like? As part of Yes Magazine's new initiative, Progress 2025, we turn today to Ivan Espinosa Madrigal, the Executive Director of Lawyers for Civil Rights Boston. Welcome to the program, Ivan.
Thank you very much for having me.
So first, let's talk about this issue of that has been consuming social media and traditional media as well. How do you explain the Republican playbook? Because we really should look at it not just as Trump and J.D. Vance, but the Republican playbook of spreading lies about immigrants in Springfield, Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio.
It is very unfortunate that we find ourselves in this particular predicament where rumors are being created and spread about immigrant communities. And I want to start by making very clear that at Lawyers for Civil Rights, we are completely nonpartisan. And so we are in the business of making sure that people's civil rights are being respected. And that includes immigrants. That includes immigrant communities. And we need to make sure that immigrant communities were often very much being marginalized and maligned by political rhetorics, by really clear attempts to inject false narratives into the American ethos. This is what we have seen historically with Haitian communities. This is what we have seen historically with many Latino and Black immigrants and Asian immigrants. And so what we are seeing right now unfold with respect to the alleged consumption of pets is simply unacceptable. And it demonizes immigrants who are part and parcel of our communities, who are part of our social fabric and who contribute to the economic resilience of our communities. So it's shameful that rumors are spread about the consumption of pets and that rumors spread about Haitian migrants and that the perception of bad hombres, referring to Mexicans, continue to be something that has political currency right now, but it most certainly shouldn't.
You're referring to a comment made several years, 4 or 5 years ago now by Trump. Now, how serious a threat does to immigration and to immigrants, to their rights and dignity as humans, how serious a threat does Project 2025 represent? I mentioned that it suggests or encourages dismantling not just any sort of security that immigrants might have or any sort of safety around the border and the rights of undocumented immigrants, but also decimating the legal pathways, many of them, visa categories for people seeking to come here with papers, right?
Absolutely. What we are seeing is not just narrative that focuses on demonizing specific immigrant communities, tired tropes about Haitian migrants being undesirable, about the consumption of pets, or about the criminal nature of the people crossing the border. These are all narratives that are false. And what we're now seeing is really a combination of these narratives with very specific policy initiatives that are meant to unwind and dismantle entire immigration programs. So this includes significant barriers to asylum or the elimination of asylum protections altogether. This includes not just the militarization of the border with Mexico, but also making sure that even asylum seekers cannot present themselves at the border. All of these have in one form or another been part of the policy recommendations and policy proposals that we are seeing percolating across the country leading to the November election. And so we are very concerned about the idea that policy initiatives and policy proposals are specifically targeting immigrants. And they're targeting immigrants of color, to be very clear. The immigrants arriving in the United States were from Scandinavia, we would be having a very different conversation right now. But instead, what we are seeing is a retreat and dismantling from protections that have existed for generations, like the ability to surrender at the border while requesting asylum protection. This fundamental right, which is enshrined not just in our immigration law, but in international obligations, is what's at stake as we go into the November election.
What you're referring to is actually something that the Biden administration has espoused just in the early part of the summer. Biden, in keeping with the Trump rhetoric, has placed severe restrictions for asylum seekers. He's talked, in January about shutting down the border, securing our border. And he has even kept in place some of Trump's restrictions. So on the one hand, you have Republicans, saying mass deportations now, as the signs of the RNC were saying. And on the other hand, you have Democrats almost trying to outdo the Republicans on their tough on immigration rhetoric. And I'm wondering now, first of all, why you think that is, because it seems as though immigrants just become these very convenient scapegoats every time we have elections. And why you think Democrats don't lean into a humane approach on immigration rather than letting Republicans set the agenda, letting the anti-immigrants set the agenda?
I completely agree. It's almost like a race to the bottom. It's who can outdo the other in the anti-immigrant policies that are being proposed. And this is incredibly harmful and damaging. We are seeing this from all sides of the political spectrum. We're seeing it from Republicans that are trying to come up with creative and novel ways of disenfranchising even legal immigrants to Democrats who are fortifying the border and making sure that they're not being left behind in the efforts to exclude immigrants. And so you're completely right that what we are seeing cuts across the political spectrum. And what's interesting is that at the very beginning of the Biden administration, there was a lot of concern in Washington about immigration being the third rail, immigration costing us the election. And in many ways, with the Biden administration retreating from immigration advocacy, retreating from humanitarian postures, what we have done is essentially concede the immigration space to really conservative elements that are not aligned with American values, that are not aligned with the economic reality of the country. Most Americans support asylum and refugee protections. And if you ask them about the fall of Afghanistan or the fall of Ukraine or the fall of Venezuela, they all understand that these countries have imploded and that we need to do our part to be able to support refugees. And so most Americans support refugee protections. The same goes with the economic argument for immigrants. Most Americans understand that the reason why they have to wait in line because there are not enough cash registers, the reason why we don't have enough waiters or housekeeping staff at restaurants or hotels, or why you have to wait so long to see a doctor, is precisely because we don't have enough immigrants who are coming into the country to do jobs at every level, from construction work to scientists and innovators. And so it's also an economic disconnect across the political aisle, because we're not seeing the need, the urgency of making sure that we have talent in this country that can come from abroad. And the third element that is important to underscore is family unity, which is a fundamental American value. We want families to be united. And so across all of this, asylum, the economy, and family unity, most Americans support a really novel and really practical immigration policy. That's not what we're seeing today.
I'm wondering if, I want to pick up on what you were saying about the reasons why people come to the United States, because that often gets left out of the discussion around immigration, particularly during election time. The assumption is that immigrants are coming here to take away people's jobs, that they're sort of greedily eating up all our resources and leaving the rest of us to fend for ourselves, and you know, get the crumbs off of the table. What does part of the answer to a progressive vision for immigration involve examining the reasons why people travel to the United States in the first place? And I know that your organization has led fact-finding missions to the border to find that out, right?
Absolutely. The root causes of migration are critical. The root causes of migration include American intervention abroad. Look, for example, at what we left in our wake leaving Afghanistan, and how so many people who had worked with the armed forces as translators, as other intelligence operatives, were left in Afghanistan. And so when we're talking about migration, we're talking about a direct American impact in many of the countries where migration is surging. We're also talking about some of the other elements that I had put on the table. We're talking about migrants who are coming to the United States because they want to contribute to our economy and be innovators. And so that's an important element of the immigration conversation, which is often lost. We don't talk about that. We don't talk about immigrants who come to the U.S. to invest. And the third category of immigration is, of course, family reunification, which is a huge element of what we see. Even Trump, Trump's wife is from Europe. She's not a U.S.-born U.S. citizen. And so when we talk about...
And she brought her parents to the United States to reunify her family based on legal pathways to immigration that were available to her, which unfortunately aren't available to everybody. But yeah, that's a really important point.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Sonali. And there you see not just the family reunification piece, but what some people prerogatively call chain immigration. And so when we talk about immigration and we get hung up on these tropes of immigrants are criminals or immigrants are eating pets, we are not having the nuanced conversation about the fact that many small businesses are being launched by immigrants. The fact that we're waiting longer to be able to see a doctor because we don't have enough talent coming from abroad to be able to occupy nursing positions, occupy home health aid positions, things that are critical for baby boomers. And so when we talk about immigration in this one-dimensional way, it really loses the importance of the issue. And in addition to that, it makes it very hard for us to make meaningful progress, because a comprehensive immigration solution needs to take into account all of this. It needs to take into account the refugees, the asylum seekers at the border. It needs to take into account family reunification, like what Trump and his wife have done themselves. And it needs to take account that we need more nurses and doctors, among with many other laborers, to be able to keep our economy vibrant. And so all of this is part of the immigration conversation. So when we just talk about cats and dogs, that is completely amiss. It is so disconnected from the way most Americans understand immigration, and it does a huge disservice. And I think as we lead into the election, what we need is to push for a more inclusive narrative, a more humane narrative, a narrative that is not just humane, but that also makes economic sense, and a narrative that shouldn't be a blue or red, a D or R issue. It should be what we as Americans see as useful for the country. And this has implications of race. This has implications of gender. This has implications of sexual orientation. All of these things are connected to immigration. And so it's really important for us to have a more sophisticated conversation that goes far beyond eating dogs and cats.
Right. And of course, that false narrative also suggests that the lives of dogs and cats are more important than those of the human beings living in that community. So it sounds to me that you're saying that a progressive vision for immigration involves a multi-pronged approach that takes into account U.S. policies that makes life difficult for people in other nations and drives them, you know, to come to the United States simply to survive, but also takes into account the economic needs of the United States and how immigrants can fulfill those, sort of a symbiotic relationship that benefits everybody, and also to change the rhetoric and the narrative from the very simplistic, reductive, and frankly racist rhetoric that we have during election about securing the border, keeping people out, and that they're supposedly taking our jobs. So a multi-pronged mm-hmm. approach. Of course, that doesn't fit on a placard as nicely as mass deportations now or secure the border. So nuance is really, really important. If you had the ear of the future president, what would you tell them in the first 100 days of their administration that you as someone enmeshed in this issue would like to see them do, even if it's something as short term as undoing the damage of recent policies?
I think undoing the damage is certainly an important thing. And frankly, we're still in the process of cleaning up much of the Trump era damage. That hasn't just gone away because we have the Biden administration. We continue to this day, work on the reunification of families who were separated at the border because the Biden administration hasn't necessarily expedited that process. And so this is about repair and about making sure that we address past injustices. But I would be much more aggressive than that. And I would say we need a form of legalization, a structure for comprehensive immigration reform that takes into account what we're talking about. The slogan should be comprehensive immigration reform, and that shouldn't be demonized, and that shouldn't be triggering, and that shouldn't be perceived as something that is unachievable and unattainable or the third rail. We need comprehensive immigration reform that can be felt economically, in family circles, in refugee circles, that can really lift all boats. That's the progressive agenda. And it's not just a progressive agenda, it's a common sense agenda that is tied to business growth, that is tied to the needs of industries from healthcare to construction. And so when we talk about what is a humane immigration policy, this humane immigration policy benefits all of us. It lifts all boats. And so it's important for us not to talk about this as just a drain, which you alluded to, Sonali, which is so true. Most people think immigrants are a drain. We need to think about this as an investment in our collective future. And the other really important element that we haven't touched on, and we could spend an entire segment on this, is climate change and climate refugees. And as we think about what the future holds, we need to also be thinking about climate refugees. And so this is extremely multi-pronged and multifaceted. But what I want to make sure is that as listeners are taking all this in, if you care about climate, you care about immigration. If you care about the services that will be available to you as you age and need home health aid service, you care about immigration. If you care about how long you're waiting for a doctor's appointment, you care about immigration. If you care about what's happening abroad, maybe due to war or other types of destruction or American intervention, then you care about immigration, right? So this is an issue that connects us in so many ways that go beyond the eating of cats and dogs. And so when we talk about the progressive agenda, this is not just a progressive agenda, it's an opportunity to have a big tent that includes many of us in the community. And so let's not shy away from that, and let's not have the common denominator be this fight to the bottom, this rush to the bottom that is happening because we want to demonize and scapegoat with immigrants. We need to rise above that, and we need to be practical in the way we do that. And that means opposing policies, whether they're being proposed by progressive administrations or conservative administrations, if they don't align with what I'll call not just a progressive agenda for immigration, but a common sense agenda for immigration.
Ivan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website for your organization, Lawyers for Civil Rights Boston.
lawyersforcivilrights.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali. As always, it's a pleasure to be in conversation with you.
My guest has been Ivan Espinosa-Madrigal, the Executive Director of Lawyers for Civil Rights Boston. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents, Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 offers a clear vision for what a future conservative presidential administration is likely to do in office. On the economy in particular, Project 2025 promotes gig work over secure union jobs that pay a living wage. It considers federal employee unions to be, quote, incompatible with democracy, and even targets child labor laws, encouraging minors access to hazardous jobs in order to mitigate worker shortages. They want, quote, lower taxes and deregulation, as well as cuts to food stamps and family assistance, quote, while maintaining a strong national defense and not raising taxes. Well, what would a progressive vision of labor and capital look like? As part of Yes Magazine's new initiative, Progress 2025, we turn today to Natalia Renta, the Senior Policy Counsel for Corporate Governance and Power at Americans for Financial Reform, where she works to change the structures of corporate decision-making to build a more equitable and sustainable economy. Welcome to the program, Natalia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So first, how serious a threat does Project 2025 pose to people's prosperity in terms of government programs being targeted, you know, programs around mitigating poverty, and also just to unions?
Absolutely. It poses a very significant threat. Project 2025 wants to give even more power to corporations and Wall Street. And I think people know that we already are living in an economy that serves the interests of corporations and Wall Street to the detriment of us. So it definitely poses a threat to go further in the wrong direction. And we need to fight back.
How do you sort of explain the overall vision of Project 2025 when taken as a whole? I look at it and I think enrich billionaires while impoverishing the rest of us. I don't know if that's sort of a way to try to understand what it is that they're trying to do, because, you know, it's a very deep 922-page policy document. But if we wanted like a basic takeaway on the aspects of it, focusing on labor and the economy, you know, would that be a fair assessment? Enrich billionaires and forget about the rest of us?
Absolutely. That would be a very fair assessment of Project 2025. They want to continue just focusing on letting corporations and Wall Street continue to just focus on very short-term returns and short-term greed, regardless of what that means for the rest of us. And it also just undermines the security of everybody else by putting the basic necessities further out of reach, and also undermining worker power, right? Like all of the power that could actually challenge this agenda, they want to undermine and curtail.
And it seems as though there are sort of two broad aspects that we need to be looking at, which is taxation. That is, you know, money that we all collectively put into a pot to fund the things that help keep us safe and to help us thrive. The rest of us are sort of disproportionately taxed more than the ones who make the most. So taxation is one big aspect of it. And the other is just people's rights in the workplace, right? Labor, organized labor, the ability to organize in a workplace so that the income that you make is fair, the benefits that you get are fair. So taxation that funds government programs and the ability of workers to determine their own fate and preserve their dignity. Would you say that those are, broadly speaking, the aspects that we focus on, that Project 2025 focuses on, and that we could also have as a focus when we think about progressive visions for the economy?
Yeah, taxes are a very big issue, right? The Trump tax cuts were a significant giveaway to big corporations and Wall Street and billionaires. And we are standing very close to a tax fight in 2025, where a lot of those are set to expire, and we'll be having a big fight about what type of country we want to live in, and, you know, whether corporations and Wall Street should pay their fair share, or if public servants and teachers are going to continue paying a higher tax rate than a lot of large corporations. So this is, you know, an important piece of Project 2025, and an important piece of a fight we'll be having next year. And, you know, as it is, corporations and Wall Street are not paying their fair share of taxes at all. And that's very important. And then on the, you know, on the flip side of Project 2025, too, you know, you have they want to take away, right, the little social safety net we do have. Right. And every time, Project 2025 and agendas like those, like, talk about fiscal responsibility, what they really mean is trying to take away the little benefits that people have for survival, while not, you know, not caring about just, you know, all of the giveaways to corporations and Wall Street that are embedded in the tax code, right? It's very, you can see a very clear contrast there.
What would a progressive vision of the economy look like if we could design a system that uplifts economic justice? What would that be?
Well, we need an economy where, you know, we and people are on the driver's seat, right? We currently have an economy that's driven by Wall Street and big corporations. So we need to first have, you know, have make sure that all of people's necessities are met, just as a very baseline, and also that our economy actually serves us, right? That it doesn't serve the interests of corporations and Wall Street, so that we have, you know, that we focus on what we need for the long term and the well-being of workers and our communities and the planet, so that, you know, it's driven by our interests and not the very, very narrow interests of the short-term interests of the 1%.
And so how does that happen? How do we make that happen? Certainly ensuring that the Trump tax cuts are allowed to expire is one thing. But then what about going further? For example, if we're focusing on taxation, Kamala Harris has backed Joe Biden's proposal for a billionaire tax. However, on I believe it's unrealized capital gains. I know we sort of don't want to get necessarily into the very details of it, but she seems to be trying to appease billionaires. There was a New York Times article where she, where billionaire donors kind of talked about how they were unhappy about the fact that she was embracing a slightly more economic, you know, populist vision in line with Biden. And days later, we saw that she kind of pulled back on the tax rate, the increased tax rate that she thought billionaires ought to pay. What would a progressive vision for taxation look like? I mean, should billionaires even exist? I think, you know, when we talk about big picture, shouldn't we discuss that? I mean, does anybody need $1 billion?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, the phrase that billionaires are a policy failure is very apt here. Yeah. I think, you know, we really need stronger regulation and oversight, right? And that is all, that's another really important piece that's all over Project 2025, and an agenda that's been brought forth by elites is like trying to undermine, right, the regulatory agencies that are there to serve our interests, right? They're trying to, they've had a longstanding campaign, for example, on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a very hard fought for agency that is there in defense of consumers, right? It's an agency that says like our, you know, our mission is to protect consumers of financial products. And it was one of the big wins after the financial crisis in the Dodd-Frank Act, which is the law that passed in response to that. And a lot of our opponents have been fighting to undermine the effectiveness of that agency. They actually challenged, we had a good Supreme Court decision this term actually, that found that the way it's funded, you know, is completely constitutional and legal. So that was a big win for us. But that is the type of, you know, of entity, right? That like public entity that's for the public interest, that's for consumers, right? We need more of those structures to defend the interests of workers, consumers, and, you know, everyday people, so we have this countervailing force, right? And that's just been a longstanding agenda to try to undermine structures like that. They've also set their sights on trying to undermine the power of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is, you know, the Wall Street watchdog, right? Protecting everyday investors, those of us lucky to have something like a 401k, you know, and they've been trying to undermine the Securities and Exchange Commission's power, right, to protect everyday investors from larger harms. So we need to protect these institutions, and we need to also, you know, protect the NLRB and make sure that workers have everything they need to organize and defend their interest in our economy. That's very important to increase worker power for all of us, right, to live in a
so those a government world. Those government regulatory agencies that keep billionaires and their you know, keep them in check, those are really, really critical. And of course, Project 2025 wants to decimate those. Then keeping worker unions strong. The NLRB under the Biden administration was a lot more proactive in actually fulfilling its mandate. And, you know, it's not even a very it's not even a very empowered agency. It's there to make sure that employers follow the law and you know, try to hold them accountable, albeit with fines that end up being the cost of business rather than any punitive response. But then there's also just these big government programs that we know work, right? Like, for example, the child tax credit really, really had a huge impact on curtailing childhood poverty. We've also, you know, we have our food stamps program. There are questions around reparations for Black Americans to compensate for past harms. The big government programs that distribute our collective taxes to those who need them most, those also have to be part of our progressive vision for the economy, right?
100%, yes. And when people don't have the basic needs to live, you know, that actually creates a situation where predatory financial products flourish, right? Like payday loans with terribly ridiculous interest rates that are just impossible to pay back, right? And then people fall further and further into debt. So, you know, this is what happens, right? When we don't have the means to make ends meet, like month after month, then there are all these predatory products out there where, you know, that can take advantage of us. So I think, you know, that should always be step number one is, you know, there are certain things that everyone needs and everyone should have access to so that, you know, so that we can all have what we need to survive and thrive instead of that being taken advantage of by other interests, right?
And so finally, what would you suggest for an incoming administration in 2025 as the first, you know, 100-day actions to make the economy fairer, to make it more equitable, to promote economic justice? What would Progress 2025, if it were a document, look like for on economy?
Yeah, absolutely. So policies to increase worker power. Policies to rein in Wall Street, because those are two sides of the same coin, and policies for a fair tax system, and policies so that we have what, you know, the basic necessities, right? And for example, like housing is, you know, a bigger and bigger issue in this country. It's further and further out of reach. It's extremely expensive, both.
Right. We didn't even get to talk about housing. That's a really important aspect of economic justice, and one that at least Kamala Harris seems to have some sort of plan on, even if it doesn't necessarily go far enough. She's got a plan that involves giving, I believe it's $25,000 to first-time home buyers. I might suggest that we go even further than in preventing Wall Street hedge fund investors from using housing as a speculative industry, right?
Yes, that is a huge issue. You know, there are more and more private equity owned real estate driving up prices, especially in certain areas. And another big issue we're seeing is homeowners insurance going up so high that people can't afford it anymore. And, you know, there's a because of the climate crisis and this insurance, these insurance companies on the one hand are trying to avoid the costs of covering, you know, covering costs after some climate fueled disaster, while they're also, you know, investing on the other side in fueling the climate crisis. So more and more, this is becoming a huge issue for homeowners to be able to stay in their homes and to be able to, you know, live. Live in a home that's climate resilient. So there are so many different issues to tackle. But yes, we can never leave housing out because that's such a basic necessity. And it's one that's getting further out of reach for many reasons, including these powerful financial actors, insurance companies on one hand, and also, you know, private funds that are buying up a lot of the homes. So a lot to tackle, I would say, for an economically just future for all of us.
And of course, the economy is top of mind for voters. Over and over again, they bring that up as the main thing that they are concerned about, which is not surprising given that people still struggle to put food on the table. And no matter what the jobs report says every month, it really matters whether your paycheck goes far enough to be able to buy groceries every month. And nefarious conservative actors can take advantage of that very real sense of injustice that people are feeling and distract them with things like racist anti-immigrant rhetoric. Well, I want to thank you so much, Natalia, for joining us. Give out a website for your organization, Americans for Financial Reform.
Yes, it's ourfinancialsecurity.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Thank you again so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Natalia Renta, Senior Policy Counsel for Corporate Governance and Power at Americans for Financial Reform, where she works to change the structures of corporate decision-making to build a more equitable and sustainable economy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Donald Trump and his presidential campaign have already promised that if he loses the presidential race this November, it means the election was stolen. It is as strong a hint as he can make that he intends to steal the election one way or another himself. We've heard much about fears of a repeat of the January 6th insurrection as we head toward the 2024 elections. But what about the fake electors who submitted falsified documents on Trump's behalf to Congress for the 2020 election? It turns out that they and others like them may be an even greater threat to the nation's democracy than the January 6th insurrectionists. A new effort called Insurrection Exposed by the Center for Media and Democracy aims to shed light on what the 2020 fake electors did and how a new crop could do the same 4 years later. Joining me to tell us all about it is Arne Pearson, Executive Director at the Center for Media and Democracy. Welcome to the program, Arne.
Thank you for having me.
So for those of us who missed that story, or maybe we saw it and then the chaos of 2020, we didn't, you know, we put it out of our mind. Tell us what happened in these handful of states where that mattered, where people posed as electors, right? We don't have a direct democracy when it comes to electing the president. We have this terribly undemocratic, well, proxy democracy called the Electoral College. And so people cast votes on behalf of those who vote in states. And in 2020, a bunch of them sort of pretended to be electors and cast votes for Trump.
Yeah, yes, that's what happened. So in seven states, there were fake slates of electors that were created that were then transferred to Congress in an attempt to undermine the certification of the election. And, you know, in 2020, the firewalls held, right? And there were a couple of counties that refused to certify initially. There were a lot of lawsuits. There were the fake electors. There was the insurrection in D.C. But at the end of the day, firewalls held and the election was certified. What's happened since then is that the election deniers have spent 4 years infiltrating the election administration apparatus in the states. So we now have in the eight swing states that we looked at in our most recent report, we have over 200 election deniers who are in public office, election administration positions, or party leadership.
And I mean, what happened to the other fake electors? I understand that, you know, it's a crime to illegally, you know, claim that you are an elector for Trump and to cast documents. I mean, some of these people actually falsified documents. They created fake documents. They got them notarized, right? So you said the guardrails held. Does that mean that they were prosecuted, they were convicted? Has there been accountability for what was done in 2020 with these fake electors?
A lot of it is still in process. Some of the cases are still going. Some of the electors pled, and some have been let off for various reasons, but that's sort of still ongoing. But meanwhile, those fake electors, a lot of those fake electors that are running for Congress, they're in positions of state party leadership, or some of them are administering elections at the county level.
So accountability varies. Is there some overlap between those who posed as fake electors in 2020 and those who are sort of infiltrating election boards in 2024?
There is some, but it is much broader than that, really. When you come down to it now, I think we're looking at a bigger threat than we faced in 2020. So just looking at, for instance, the counties that refused to certify election results in 2020. In the eight states we looked at, there were two in 2020. And by 2022, there were 10 counties that refused to certify the election results. And we now have found 15 counties where election deniers hold a majority on the local election boards.
And the reason that's 15 counties, and I imagine these are all in swing states.
Yes, in those eight swing states. Yeah. And, so, you know, if the counties, even if it's small, if the counties refuse to certify the results, it holds up certification of the state results and transferring it to Congress, and people have to go to court to try and force them to certify the results. And the real threat is that while that drags out, the MAGA crowd will, we expect, you know, create disinformation, hysteria over a stolen election, non-citizens voting, etc.
Now, did the Trump administration in 2020, you know, because he was an incumbent in 2020, did the fact that he was an incumbent benefit or give him an advantage or give these electors an advantage? I mean, right now in 2024, he's coming at it from the outside, right? It seemed as though he was able to take advantage of the fact that he was already in the White House and he could just simply stay. And he marshaled the forces of the Justice Department in unethical ways to try to steal the election. He doesn't have that advantage this time, right?
Well, he does not. What he has is a infrastructure of election denial groups, MAGA groups, which there are many now, that are working to spread the disinformation about election widespread election fraud and to try and control the apparatus. So, I mean, they're talking about having 175,000 poll watchers this time. And those are, you know, it's a network of people run by folks like Cleta Mitchell, who was involved in the insurrection last time, who are well positioned to create fake news about election irregularities and a stolen election.
Do you think that there's enough being made of these efforts? I mean, there are news articles, of course, explaining that Trump is putting these things into place, but is there enough attention?
You know, I think the press has been doing a much better job this time of warning mm-hmm. what could come. I know we were one of the few outlets that warned about what was coming down the pike in 2020. And also, you know, there has been a lot of progress at the state and federal level to sort of reinforce the guardrails. So you have the Electoral Reform Count Act, the Electoral Count Reform Act, which makes it harder to subvert the election at the congressional level. There have been some improvements at the state level. And in 7 of the 8 swing states, you have Democrats in control of the state election administration process. So, you know, it is unlikely that they will be able to block the certification of the election. But the bigger threat in our mind is that they will use the delay and the litigation around forcing certification to buy time to whip up hysteria about non-citizens stealing the election, about the election being stolen, and to create the atmosphere for another January 6th.
So it's not just the January 6th type insurrection by itself. It's not just fake electors by itself, but one laying the groundwork for the other and that confluence of factors that could yeah. result in so much chaos that we lose control of the democracy.
Right. I mean, look, if they can create fake news about immigrants eating dogs and cats to the point where you have to have state police in schools in Springfield, Ohio, imagine what kind of hysteria they can whip up around immigrants stealing the election. I think that's what we're looking at.
So what is the proactive response to this?
So there's a huge legal effort underway with hundreds of lawyers who are, you know, ready to deal with the lawsuits that are coming. So in that sense, there's better preparation this time as well. Yeah, you know, and I think the importance of the report and the role that we can play is to get the warning out in advance that this is the playbook. So when it comes, people are prepared to call it what it is and counter it and hopefully diffuse it somewhat by saying, hey, look, we're pretty sure this is what they're going to do in 7 weeks.
Right. So we are talking about states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Arizona, you know, these are all of the 8 swing states that are at play, Wisconsin. What should people be looking out for if they live in those states that you're recommending that's, you know, doesn't involve needing to be a lawyer? Or is it too late now because yeah. they've already been on these election boards?
Well, so you have 15 counties where they hold a majority, and that's going to be problematic. But there again, I think calling it out in advance makes it harder for them to pull that trick when the time comes. And it is certainly our hope in putting out the report that local press in those states will pick up the story and look at who's on their county boards and who the deniers are and expose who those folks are, so that people on the ground, people, you know, at the local level know who they are in advance.
And that can all be found at that website, Insurrection Exposed. So for people living in those states in Georgia, Arizona, Michigan, New Mexico, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin can go and look up for each state who the election deniers are that are running for Congress and who are also on the election boards?
Yes. All on our website. And we started the website shortly after the 2020 insurrection both to profile who the groups and players and funders were and politicians were behind what happened in 2020 and 2021, but also to start laying the groundwork for the understanding that that was a practice run and they're going to try this again. So yes, there are hundreds of profiles on there of all the key actors, and there's a section on these swing states and who the election deniers are in the key positions.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Arn. Thanks for giving, you know, helping sound the alarm on this.
Hey, thank you very much.
My guest has been Arn H. Pearson, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. InsurrectionExposed.org is that website again. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.